welcome to the fourth of the six engagement and learning to learning session sponsored by the Canadian Social Economy Hub and the steering committee of the 2010 National Summit on People-Centered Economy. It's the first time ever we will have a summit of that kind in Canada, mobilizing organizations across sector in the social economy and the CED movement, and it will be in Ottawa in the next few weeks, and we're hoping that everyone on the line will have a chance to participate or contribute between now, the telelearning session, and the event by itself. Like I said many times, we ask everyone to put their line on mute using *6 to do so, and that will help everyone not to have any background noises, but really to be able to focus on the different presentation. So my name is Itel Cote. It's really a topic. I've been involved in the field of social economy and CED for the last 30 years, and during the last 8-9 years, I've been involved on the international scene, building network or playing key roles at different level, training, technical assistance, and also connecting the dots amongst network in the movement. But I'm part of the International Committee of SEDNET and board also the Canadian Crossroad International and former board members of RIPES, Intercontinental Network of Promotion of Social Solidarity Economy. So I'm pleased to facilitate this telelearning session, and I think it's a very, it's a topic, it will sure capture your attention. The CSE Hub is a national social economy research program that is co-led by the University of Victoria and the Canadian CED Network. It involves practitioner organizations, universities across Canada with a national hub and six regional centers at different parts of the country. Through funding from the federal government, Social Science and Humanities Research Council, research has been undertaken to understand how the approaches of the social economy can be better understood and effectively applied so that community organizations, civil society, community developers, and researchers can collaborate to empower groups and communities to meet their social and economic needs. This Global People-Centered Economy Telelearning Session is based also on the research and the issue papers written by Ian McPherson and by Yvonne Poirier, and I will speak about it a bit more and introduce themselves. There's a few ways to participate between during this conference call, during this telelearning session, between now and the summit, and at the summit by itself, by your presence. We invite everyone to go on the wiki if you want to make any suggestion to improve the issue paper or make any suggestion on any talks on that specific theme of the National Summit or any other themes, one of the five other themes in the summit. So please, when you join us, do *6 to mute your line, and you can also go on the chat room, because during that telelearning session, people could go in the chat room, raise questions, share ideas, and I will go in the chat room and pick up a few questions that we can raise at the question period. So the chat room is www.chatzy.com/CSEHub. So www.chatzy.com/CSEHub. And already we have 13 people online. So, let's go right to the subject, the towards a global people-centered economy, and we'll have an hour altogether until 1 o'clock. This session is based, like I said, on two discussion papers, the National Summit issue paper, towards a global people-centered economy, written by Yvonne Poirier, International Committee of Canadian SEDNET, and the other paper written by Ian McPherson, co-director of CSE Hub, about the international cooperative movement. Ian will speak first, and Yvonne will follow, and they have 10 minutes each. And Ian is the founder of the British Columbia Institute for Cooperative Studies at the University of Victoria and co-director of the Canadian Social Economy Hub. He's got a long list of involvement, but what is very interesting also with all the work Ian is doing to consolidate, support, promote, document the whole movement. He wrote many books on the English-Canadian cooperative movement from 1900 to 1945, the Cooperative Union of Canada, Cooperative Insurance Services, Cooperative Trust Company, the British Columbian Credit Union Movement, and the International Credit Union Movement. And God knows we need that kind of documentation to tell stories and remember how the movement is built. So thank you, Ian, to be one of our speakers. He will be followed by Yvon Poirier, who has been the chair of the International Committee of the Canadian CED Network since 2007. He was a member of the board of directors of the Groupe Économie Solidaire du Québec, the GESC, from 2004-2008. He's also a member of the Coordination Committee of RIPES North America, the Intercontinental Network of Promotion of Social Solidarity Economy of North America. He's been actively involved in Intercontinental Network since 2004, and he's been involved in different activity and movement building throughout the world, in Dakar in Africa, Luxembourg in Europe, and Asian Economy Forum in Manila and Tokyo, and also involved in the World Social, participate to the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre and Belém, and in Solidarity, Canadian has been also supportive to our sisters and brothers in the States to build a solidarity economy network there, and helping since the foundation of that network since 2007. So each person will go and present their topic. Please, everyone, mute your line, star 6, and I will invite Ian to take the stand.
Thank you very much. Does anyone have any difficulty hearing me?
It's perfect, Ian.
Okay, good. As I said, there was a paper. Actually, there will be two short papers available to you, and they are what they are is one of them is the speech I gave in Brazil not too long ago, and then a second one is a little introduction to a journal by a Japanese cooperative, Sigatsu Club. And they deal in very simple ways and very short order with this whole theme of cooperatives and cooperative movements and internationalization. I just want to state that I believe the cooperative movement is a home within the social economy. I equally believe that it and the other forms of social economy organizations deserve to be studied on their own terms and in their own ways, and then linked as that makes possible. Talking about the relationships between cooperatives and internationalism, there's actually quite limited research into it when you think about it. There are some descriptive pieces, but it's not really well examined. And in fact, there are a number of us who are starting to do some serious work on this, and I'm very, very excited by that. Anyway, limited research and not a whole lot of focused thought, I would say, on the theme of cooperatives and internationalization. There's some very good work that was done in the 1950s, mostly by Scandinavians. But since then, I'm not really sure we can say that beyond descriptive pieces and kind of institutional understandings that we've gone very far. For those of you who are not familiar with Johnston Herzl's book, The International Cooperative Movement, is from Manchester, 1997. I see I have the wrong date down there in my paid notes. Anyway, it's from 1997, and it's, again, a descriptive piece, very useful in its way, but I'm not sure it gets into the kinds of issues we need to think about in terms of cooperatives and internationalizations. And partly it has to do with the complexities of the cooperative past, and I'll be talking more about that. Cooperatives have a very complex history, and it's a tremendously varied around the world. You only have to travel and look to see that. There are also institutional challenges to it, because it's usually configured with institutional priorities, and that tends to, I think, in a way interfere with really strong international connections. And finally, I would say this is a vitally important issue for cooperative studies, which to me is the body of thought and work and research we need to understand cooperatives, cooperative movement, cooperative thought, cooperation generally, much more deeply and powerfully than we do. So, that's a bit of introduction, suggesting some of the challenges. Inheritance, well, that's kind of an interesting one. I toyed, if I'd had a couple of hours, I would have talked a lot about whether human beings are inherently cooperative or competitive. The answer, of course, is they are both. But that we tend in our world to always emphasize the competitive side to our cost, yes, rather than looking for the appropriate balance there might be. In the cooperative movement, is a long-standing movement going back, and you can trace it back to possible starting dates, but usually it's into the early 19th century. But I would argue that really its most important roots lie back in the 18th century, and with the Enlightenment and the conceptions of internationalism that came out of the 18th century, when European people began to think much more seriously about the rest of the world. Now, that's a Eurocentric perspective for sure, and there are weaknesses in it. But in our world, it was that kind of effort in the 18th century that was, I think, very important and shaped in many ways the perceptions of people who started and built cooperative movements. There's a Robert Owen, who's well known, I think, to everybody, had an association of all classes of all nations in 1835, which the name gives it all. It never reached the significance he hoped, but it had a big impact in cooperative circles. And the idea is cooperation is an international force. And it was embedded, and it's a part of the movement from the beginning. Fortunately or unfortunately, the cooperative movement is made up in people, because we all fall significantly short of the marks we set for ourselves, and that was no less true in the past than today. So whether it was achieved in the way even that Robert Owen meant is always a debatable thing. You can also think about internationalism from the perspective of national co-op movements, and the British and the French are usually featured in these kinds of discussions. But in fact, you can carry it much, much farther. And it's interesting when you think about how different cooperative movements in different nations consider the world, they see them differently a little bit sometimes. And that's interesting, actually, leaves room for a lot of good reflection. The tensions and how the types of co-ops, consumer, producer, banking, et cetera, those tensions affected international perspectives. I'll never forget being in Mali and trying to explain why the workers from Desjardins generated a different kind of cooperatives than the workers from what was then the Cooperative Union of Canada. It was a really interesting thing, but it's actually a variation of what I'm getting at. There are generations of type, there are generations of nationality. So the French see international cooperatives a little differently from the British, or the Germans, the Italians, the Australians. In 1895, the International Cooperative Alliance was formed, and it was to become the focus for international programs. And it's had a long and complex and difficult history. I won't get into that now. But the limitations of the 20th century, in a way, those of us who are strong supporters of the cooperative movement are always disappointed because we know how far short of the mark we have come despite what we have done. The limitations of the 20th century were the aforementioned national priorities. The complexities of imperialisms and the role of cooperatives within imperial networks is an important theme, and a complex and varied theme, really. And there are the problems of casual friends, I call them, people who use and exploit cooperatives for other purposes, and that's gone on for 150 years by all kinds of movements and organizations and ideologies. The Soviet issue really shaped a lot of international cooperative attitudes and development in the 20th century. In other words, the old rivalries between the East and the West, which have, of course, been transformed into other rivalries. There are substantial issues on contested terrain. So those similar organizations or dissimilar organizations all competing to control development or to build a new world order, however that is defined. Issues of war and peace have badly affected have seriously affected the way in which cooperatives have developed internationally and see themselves internationally. the independence movements that took place in the 50s onward, there was a mixed perception of cooperatives there. I wish you can talk with those if there's any interest in that. But it's a mixed consequence. Almost all independence movements champion cooperatives, but how they did it and why they did it is always important to think about. And then in more recent times, the victory of the market. However, all that aside, all those limitations put aside, there are 1 billion members. The UN estimates co-ops serve 3 billion peoples. There are over 300 different kinds of co-ops from the cradle to the grave. The top 300 employ 20% more people than multinationals. And wherever you look, you can find setbacks, and that's what the press and others and many people in the co-op movements always focus on, the failures of the demutualizations and all of that. But generally, at all times that I'm aware of, there are also very positive situations around the world. And in the years, the last 50 years, the increasing importance of cooperatives in the global south is probably the biggest fact in the international movement today. The largest movements are in China and India. Now, we can argue about what they really mean and what they stand for, but the size is significant and the hold they have in their areas is significant. And if you look at the importance in the financial industries, the food and energy production, food and more recently energy production, in social services, and on it goes, there's a lot that's very positive. So the possibilities of the 21st century, the market crises, I think, have demonstrated the value of organizations like cooperatives internationally and actually pose a real opportunity for international development among cooperatives and similar organizations. Environmental issues, a key area in which cooperatives are playing and play a much greater role. The addressing of community and youth concerns and the networks that could flow from those are, I think, are extremely important. We can see the revitalization of many larger co-ops, and we can see the growth of international co-ops. The insurance cooperatives have long had very effective international connections. There are examples like Mondragon of co-ops that spread across borders. And remarkable things have happened in the European common market over the last 20 years in terms of integration across nations.
2 minutes.
Yes. Do you want me to stop?
No, 2 minutes. Yes, 2 minutes left.
Perfect. New co-ops in fair trade, organic food, social co-ops, energy co-ops. It's in my view, we're living through one of the great eras of cooperative expansion around the world, although it's probably not thought of in those terms. And who knows whether in the long run they will produce the significant, long-standing, and important things that we would like, but certainly the birth is there. And in 2012, there's the United Nations Year of Cooperatives, which should be a real opportunity to look internationally at co-ops. That, in fact, is what I wrote that little piece for the Japanese journal for. The underlying challenge, I always say the underlying challenge is always knowledge, studied, understood, with results systematically compiled and made readily available. That is, in my mind, the single biggest weakness, and we constantly ignore that at our peril. Limited impact in the public square is a consequence of that. Superficial understandings and inadequately developed proposals for how the world might be more use cooperative more. There are threats of demutualization. They should not be ignored. They should be thought about. They should be examined thoroughly and alternatives found. There are some. The prevailing ideology based on competition in the free market is obviously a challenge that cooperatives can respond to on one side of their huge family, but have problems on the other. And there are also issues around the relationship with like organizations in a social economy, but also in government relations and with the sector. I will stop.
Thank you very much, Ian. And for the new people who join us on this tele-learning session about global people-centered economy, I invite you to put your line on *6 to mute your line. And we'll have the second speaker who will address us. Thank you very much, Ian. And I will capture a few key elements after the two of you speaking. You can all go to the chat line to raise some questions, but we will have also a question period online for people who are not at their computer and they want to raise some questions addressed by the speaker. So we will... follow with Yvon Poirier. I already introduced him, and he's been involved writing the paper, the National Summit issue paper on towards a global people-centered economy. Yvon?
Yes, hello. First of all, to make it, before talking about the paper and the issues in the paper, I want to make a transition with what Ian said. I come from a co-op background also. I was born in the Cajun region in PEI, which is all co-op when I was young. And I've been involved also in some co-ops here in Quebec City and in Quebec for a long time, including my credit union, which is a sort of economic credit union. It was started by the unions. Also was involved in unions. Also there, we had an international perspective. We always had our biannual conventions, international speakers. We had international committees. So we've been working internationally. I've been involved internationally, directly or indirectly, for quite a while. And then what happened also, to know some of the same people Ian knows, like Saikatsu Club in Japan, which came to Quebec a few years ago to study what we're doing here in social economy. So more and more people are quite concerned with everything that's going on now in our world, which is not working, working very well. So this is why people involved in community economic development like us, co-ops, whether we call it social economy or not, or community businesses even, and all this is people are more and more concerned because we all know that the last 15, 20 years, even if we could say that Ian just said that the market forces or the market economy has been dictating to the rest of society the rules of the game, like WTO and so forth, at the same time, it has created all the problems we have all over the world. It has created high unemployment, has created poverty in some countries, it has created upheavals in economies, like, for example, Argentina some years ago or other countries. So, and we all know about the We all know about the global warming things, and we all know about the peak oil issues, which are coming around. So, we are living in a situation which is quite, let's put it this way, quite stressing. A lot of people are even talking about the crisis of civilization, meaning that we've been living on the tails of the Industrial Revolution, which was built on cheap energy, and that's going to stop or change drastically. So it means many changes in the way people live, meaning economy, how people live in their communities and in their own countries. And I think this is where some of these things we're working on, like social economy and SED and social economy and things like that, have in fact, some sort of opportunity to be able to go forward. At the same time, even if I'm not a specialist on this history of international development, I can add that having been to different meetings, that we've been working internationally, meaning the people, for over 50 years. Now, I remember when I was much younger, that we were already concerned about the poverty in the world and how things were in Africa. I'm old enough to remember it was before the countries became independent and so forth. And also, we were always wanting to work with the people who are not so well off. So, and this is where, again, as I said, this is not an official history here, but this is where this started. Even when I was very, very young in the 1950s in PEI, we were giving, let's say, a dime a month or something like that to go to send to Chinese, to help Chinese poor, which, of course, this was going to the churches and so forth. But these issues of international solidarity and work internationally are quite well-rooted in most communities, and we remember all that. Yeah. After that, what happened is that this is where the NGOs, most international NGOs I've heard about, the big ones, like in Canada, have been around for about 50, 60 years. They started out mostly like some sort of a charity approach. Like a lot of them were church-led. Then, for example, the CICI, who most of us here know, it was based in Montreal. It used to be a Jesuit organization. Now it's a lay organization. And a lot of this is where it started. People wanted to help the poor and so so forth. And then they evolved, and then the international government, and then the governments came around. Of course, we know, remember what happened with after the Second World War, Marshall Plan, and so forth. But quite soon afterwards, our countries, northern countries, started to have plans to help people in the south. So this is where the CEDO and other agencies like that were created, and funding were sent to the government and so forth. So we've had international aid now, to speak on this a little bit, for about 40, 50 years, but the poverty issue is as bad as it was, in a sense, and we could say that the gap between the rich and the poor countries are probably as big as they were 50 years ago. So we're facing very large global problems here. Now, I had a very good opportunity to be at Accra a couple of years ago, where there was a meeting of civil society organizations who were working on discussions of aid, and this is where they came up. This is where they insist an awful lot on the how communities take over and they get involved in creating co-ops or community organizations and so forth. It has to be empowerment from below. So this is my experience over the last many years has been clearly, I was also working in SID in Quebec City here in the downtown poor sections of the city, and this is the same approach that we are working on, and I'm glad to say that what I've seen in different parts of the world, like in India or other countries, people are doing the same approach. I mean, the success stories I could talk about a lot. This is where people got together and they created a collective approach to the economy, whatever it was. It could be community organizations, community villages, it could be co-ops, it could be different other issues, but this is clearly the approach which has success, and we need to tell these stories, which are very good, because the top-down type of development hasn't worked. A lot of funding went to the southern countries, like in Africa, for big dams or whatever, huge projects that were supposed to solve the problems, and we all know that they didn't solve the problem. So we have to have the different approaches.
3 minutes.
Yeah, to come back to the paper, which I'll be short because you already have the paper, I would just add that I've tried to make something which can be create consensus so we can get things that have been, and remind, the current state of view reminds us that Canada was a leader, I say was, and since it was, it's not anymore. And then the key players here in this part, it's more or less, I think next final paper we need to talk more about people involved in the CCIC, Canadian Center for International Cooperation. The top issues, the next section, I've tried to put there, and this is, and I hope you can read again and send comments either in the wiki or send comments to me up to May 15th, because afterwards you have to make a final paper here. So this is trying to set the stage for what the last section, which is the proposals. So you need to, I want you to look and see if it's clearly linked, the issues here, and then the proposals that come out later. And the last section, the proposals themselves, this is what we want to work at most at the summit. I can already add that I've had a few comments, and I will probably suggest, and you can think about this and send the comments or talk in a few minutes. I've had a suggestion to add another one, which has been going on over the world the last years, is to have some sort of a taxation of some kind on international transactions, whether it be just financial transactions, like the Tobin tax people have talked about some years ago, or other types of control of taxation, of levy or some kind. Some people call it an international levy. There was the last social forum in Brazil talked about that. And even within the G20 members, some countries are pushing this. And I can just add that Canada's against it, so it must be good, this proposal, to get spread the joke. Some of the countries are against it, clearly, but we have to really look at this, and this we can work on a recommendation for the summit. This might replace the small note on recommendation 2 saying we should raise to 1%. I think if we do add another one, which would have taxation on transactions, which would give funding for international fight, let's say global warming, or to help underdeveloped countries or developing countries, I think this would we won't need that part. So I guess since you have the paper, I won't add anything else right away, and we can discuss longer. Okay.
Well, thank you, Yvonne. Thank you, Ian. And just to remind everyone, you can go on the chat line to post your question. You can also, like Yvonne said, go to on the wiki to improve the issue paper. And both Ian and Yvonne raised there are global issues, global crisis, and different contexts throughout the social economy movement or the CED movement or the social solidarity economy movement. A lot of activities are going on for years and years, mobilizing billions of people. There's already a people-centered economy. Some people say it's a well-kept secret in some context, but we do document more and more that practice, and we do learn from the experience. Also, there's an opportunity, and Ian gave a good sense about how we play an active role in new component of the economy, in alternative energy, in food and fair trade, to relocalize the economy, to create wealth throughout the world, but also at different levels. There's a few questions already on the wiki, and people who are not connected on the internet, you'll be able to unmute your line one at a time doing *6. We'll invite you to name your name, where you are in Canada, your position, and raise briefly and address your question briefly, and we'll have either one of the two speakers or both speakers answer to your question. I will take one already on the website. Sabine Lair raised a question. She had a whole context to her question referring to Canadian interest in the international, in our own international involvement, through military, through mining, through doing business across the world in Africa and elsewhere. And she's wondering, in the spirit of internationalism and international solidarity, the paper, the issue paper, should not also recommend to put more pressure on the Canadian government in this regard? How can we build a global people-centered economy if we let Canadian companies wreck havoc with the lives of people in the countries of Global South? So Ian and Yvonne, do you want to answer this one? And I'll go get a few others.
Yvonne, I believe
you. Yvonne?
I can try to answer
it
or respond. I don't think it's an answer. I think it's very important to keep in balance activities in several directions. It is, I think, appropriate and necessary to try to prod governments in different directions than they currently are pursuing. I agree very much with what Yvonne had to say about the development program of Canada. I've been marginally involved in it for a long time. And generally, the on-the-ground smaller projects have been more successful than the bigger ones, whether they're cooperatives or others. I only know about the cooperatives, but actually, until recently, and I haven't checked the last couple of years, but until recently, roughly $60 million of Canadian aid went to cooperatives, a little over half of it to the two national organizations. The government has been, over the years, increasingly, I guess the way to put it is they're sometimes very supportive, sometimes they're not. But anyway, I think it's important to try to push governments. I think it's important to try to affect the way in which we extend international assistance and how we build or help people build more accurately. But I think it's easy to get so caught up in the political lobbying dimension that we don't pay enough attention to building up the institutional and structural frameworks, whether they're cooperatives or others, to make a difference. And I think there's a lot of attention needs to go to that, to understand what works and what hasn't worked, to try to cement the relationships in fair trade, for example, or in refugee issues. I think that's very important. I'm involved with several people in work on cooperatives and peace, which may sound a little bit removed from what we're talking about, but I submit is not. And I think cooperatives have played a role in that that's not really recognized most particularly by people in cooperatives. And I think that it's that that work, that's actually the most important, the work that we do in building these organizations and thinking about them. It's useful to have meetings and to rally people behind. Those are wonderful experiences. But it's the walking the walk that's ultimately the most important thing. And that's what we've got to really work on and focus on.
Well, thank you, Ian. Yvonne, do you want to add something?
Yes, if I understood well the question, the question is raised also on what do we put in our proposals here, because here we are mostly on talking about people-centered economy. So indeed, we could, for example, have a change one of the proposals to include many of the issues. For example, there's a big campaign by Development and Peace against Canadian mining companies in the South, in South America, for example, and asking the federal Canadian government to control more what the companies are doing, because Canada's a haven for these mining companies, and most of them are registered in Canada. So, I mean, there are some of these issues of international solidarity which we can put in our proposals, but our proposals are mostly focused on linked to the economy directly or indirectly, even if everything, of course, is indirectly linked. So this is what I answer to this. We there are many, many, many campaigns, and we have to, for example, the whole global warming environment movement. There's things there we do support and we can support, but so this is the real debate, and I hope you can some people can comment on this, as to what do we put in specifically within our proposals, which means what do we work on the next few years as a movement, not only Sentinel, but all the other movements involved, like CCN and so forth. So this is the question that I've understood well, which is addressed here.
Thank you. And I just want to add, before I go on the phone to ask if anyone wants to ask a question, being on board of CCI, I'm quite aware, you know, all the Canadian international NGO, and mainly the one who were documenting a lot of bad impact of Canadian involvement on international, not aid, but international economic activities elsewhere, either in Africa or either in the mining, but also in the military. We do have many international NGOs sitting at the International Committee at CENET, and we do share there. But let me tell you, many of them, the more active one in lobbying the government, Canadian government, during the last few years on those issues and other issues, including international aid, some of them just renewed their funding with government. Some has not been renewed, and they will be cut, or they've been cut with a very short notice. And like Yvonne, you referred to CCIC, which is CCI, and those are the ones who have been mobilizing all the international Canadian NGO involved in all the different fields, and it just has been renewed for 3 months with a snap on their fingers saying, you know what, don't shake the boat too much, because there's issue. But let me tell you, like Yvonne said, there's a lot of many campaign out there. Thousands of Canadian and people overseas will meet also at the People Summit in parallel of the G20 in Toronto in June, and that will be another tribune to raise all of those issues. And I know that it's planned already, and in a different way to try to influence in our own context, our government, but elsewhere too. So it's a work in progress, but like Yvonne said, to improve the paper, don't hesitate to go directly on the wiki and make some suggestion, raise and propose some question and raise some write some content to improve the paper. So on the phone, we have someone who wants to raise a question, and if so, do *6 to unmute your line, and you can introduce yourself and ask your question. If not, I'll go back on the chat. That's the one. Okay, so there is a question from Kennedy, who said, is there any significant financial institution to support various co-op development in Canada? And she was that person was aware that in the U.S., the credit union was supporting a permaculture. So, Ian, do you want to...
Well, I did try to respond, but I'm not sure that I've gathered I responded very well because I see. Oh, I'm sorry, I've lost my connection now, but I see where she or he responded to saying that those sources were not sufficient or on the line that she meant for specifically for the social economy.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't. So I have to say, you know, many of the organizations that I'm thinking of, and I'm aware of, like the cooperators, they are as much interested in non-cooperative organizations and things they fund, it seems to me, or as interested. And so that, and I'm not sure that really holds. And the same was true with Vancity. I mean, they do fund. Now, in order, I see that Kennedy, pardon me, I don't know. I believe I know her or him. I don't know in the north of Ontario, though, that would apply. So that's a problem.
Okay.
I don't know those organizations up there.
Mm-hmm.
But the Co-op Development Initiative in the federal government is a possibility. The other thing I'm not quite sure when I look at it is whether she or he is thinking of the activities in Canada or in other countries. Maybe that could be.
Yeah, I could send FedNet a list because I did some research regarding social economy and CED supporting co-op, social enterprise, and any other social economic activities. We did a list of the different kind of funding and investing source in Canada throughout the country. So that's something I could probably send to Rachel and Ashley, and I have it posted somewhere. And what I'm saying about different kind of investment or funding, it could be grants, it could be contribution, it could be also loan. It depends on what kind of activity. But throughout international, I will let Yvonne probably say, because we're talking about global people-centered economy, there is an international movement mobilizing all the social finance actor, credit union, Caisse Populaire, foundation, and many others like that throughout the world. It's called INEZ. I don't know, Yvonne, if you want to add anything on that perspective about is there any financial out there, investor, financial institution supporting that movement building and investing in the people-centered economy. Yvonne?
Yes, this movement that Etel mentioned is one of the movements. It was started in Europe by Triodos Bank, which is an environmentally funding bank and has a lot of social economy organizations in Europe and financial institutions. But some of them are financial institutions, but others are more or less a community different financial institutions also. So it's a mix of different organizations there. And there's one, Vancity used to be a member. I think they might be a member now again. And there's the one, my credit union in Quebec City here is a member. So, but it's still a very, very small organization. And I can also add that Ian probably knows this better than I. I've never been to ICA meetings, but I know people who have been to ICA meetings. ICA is not a very, put it this way, it's not a very large, it's not very funded at the top level. It's not a big organization at the top level. So
International Co-op Alliance.
Yes, it has a limited capacity. I think it's the same thing with Union. So It's mostly at the country level, which are people where people are organized. But even then, there's limited funding, and most of organizations are working with their own within their own country. So when it comes to international, let's put it this way, activities, it's always limited, and that's the problem, and it's a question of funding and everything else. So it's not easy for anybody. Okay.
There is also a banking committee of the ICA.
Yeah.
They is slow, but is also.
Yeah.
Involved.
Yeah. They meeting in Montreal next year. I think it's Popular Banks. I think they call them.
Yeah. Also, People Bank.
Yeah, People Banks. And also,
they're very substantial in size, but they're not so much involved in this kind of international.
No.
That's another thing they're exploring right now. By the way, they're using different international platform to mobilize capital from different country and have that kind of a people bank to internet. And that's why they connect and they're testing to another platform, not Facebook, but Amado, that could become one of the platform for social international finance to support social economy and CD activities throughout the world. I know some key leaders are working on it, and we keep it posted, but I would invite people who are interested about funding and financing to look at the paper on that topic and also to contribute on the wiki on that topic. There's another question, but before I read another one from the chat, is there anyone online who can have access to their computer who wants to unmute their line and ask the question directly to Yvonne and Ian? No, everyone is connected probably. So Manifesto wrote a question. Ian and Yvonne, you're connected. He's participating on a study group that is looking at how to create a stream for people whose job has been lost to hiring people in work crews under a foreign worker program. How to stream these workers into the social economy? Has anyone been looking at this aspect? And Yvonne, I will start with you. You've been involved.
Sorry, I'm looking at. I have the title in front of me. Which question is it? Is it at the bottom?
Almost on the top. It's by Manifesto 2000.
Okay, let's see. Because the only Manifesto 2000 I see, it's on food.
No, there's one on the worker.
Okay.
Ian,
I found it. Well, I can. I don't know the foreign worker program, so I can't talk about that program. What I can add is that on creating co-ops, something we haven't mentioned yet today is an interesting one. Is that Ian was talking about Mondragon? They signed an agreement with the United States Steelworkers, North America Steelworkers. Sorry, because they're also in Canada. And they will have support from the Mondragon to create workers' co-ops in industrial zones here in North America. So that's one thing. But I don't know the foreign worker program.
Is it the foreign worker? I wonder if it's the foreign worker program that applies for farm workers, where, you know, we have very substantial number of people coming from Latin America and elsewhere to work in our agriculture. It could well be there. And they, that certainly does put some people out of work. The only options that occur to me are the ones you've mentioned, and that is to look at what kinds of... Mondragon started out not to make money, but to create jobs, and that was the criteria they used, the main criteria. If people got together and talked about how they could create jobs for themselves, and often amazing things happen. You know, you see it all the time with the students and others near here. It would be useful to know what that program is for sure.
I can add about the foreign worker program. Something in Quebec province that happened just recently is that they've got the right to unionize now, these foreign workers, which was not the case previously.
I just want to go back to the point that Yvonne raised. That's a very significant development, the steel workers. thinking about working with Mondragon to create worker co-ops, because I would say that one of the things that's held back worker co-ops in some parts of the country anyway has been suspicion among trade unionists that it was really an attempt to take jobs away from them, to de-skill labor and all those things. In fact, it may have been true in some instances, but by and large it's not, and it's a real option for working people to create jobs for themselves. So to have a union look at this seriously and to put resources behind it and speak out on it is a huge switch within the worker co-op field.
I can add something else here, which is interesting also from another point of view, is that Mondragon agrees at the same time to set up some type of collective bargaining, which they haven't had either.
Yeah. Mondragon is a fascinating, many people are probably aware of this, but it's a fascinating example of the internationalization of a really strongly rooted nationalist organization. It's in the Basque country and started out with and still sustains a strong commitment to Basque nationalism, but it has expanded throughout the world without a lot of controversy and agonizing about how to do that. And they've made mistakes, I think they would admit, but they've worked hard at figuring out how is it possible to create an international, in this case, cooperative entity that stays true to its values and treats its people in the way outside the country in the way they try to treat them at home.
Mm-hmm.
Big issue.
Kennedy made a reference to the multinational companies, like Canadian companies, and one solution she was proposing is Canadian companies must meet Canadian laws even when they operate abroad, until they can be held accountable in this way to abuse. The abuse will continue. And a lot of people share that point of view. It was not written in the issue paper, but I really want to invite you to go on the wiki and add it. And if you want to add any other component to your proposition, just do it. Also, there's a question, Yvon, you saw from Manifesto about the agriculture. Do you want to try to answer it? He refers to a point that needs to be examined is getting agreement on what would be a realistic tariff to be put on agricultural products that would enable all countries to have or revive healthy agriculture. Is it possible to get Canada to accept the fact that trade policies that tear down duties on food seriously damage countries that can't compete with agri-food, and rural development? So, Yvonne, that's the one you were raising a bit earlier. Do you have any ideas to...
Yes. I mean, this is one of the big issues around the world, clearly. The WTO always tries to liberalize the rules. All I can mention here is that more and more people are talking about food sovereignty as an approach to this, like Pia Campesina, which is a big international organization which is pushing this, and there's different networks around the world on working together on this issue of changing the rules of the game and the question of food. For example, the Agriculture Support by the Community Movement, which is also linked to the Via Campesina in some instances. And I can send this paper if people want it. There was a People's Summit in Rome last November at the same moment that the FAO was meeting, which is under a lot of influence by international multinational corporations, but the many farmers unions and so forth were, and Via Campesina and the peasants movements were pushing this. Clearly this will be an extremely important issue, especially since it's linked to the other issues. For example, the question of global warming, so we don't need to have fresh food from all over the world 12 months a year in the rich countries, and also the same time and the food mileage issue, which is extremely preoccupation for many people. But it's also building local economies. Like in Canada and in most countries in the world, small farms are disappearing because of this multinational corporations who control both the production of food and the sale of foods. And Canada, the wholesale of foods, practically all goes to this. So we have an awful large issue in front of us. But at the same time, all these initiatives are talking about are also making progress. It's less than probably 1% so far, but clearly this is one of the issues which is changing, and maybe it will change for other reasons, because once the petroleum oil goes up to $150-$200 a barrel, which is quite probable in the next years, people will have a huge impact on this transfer of food. So community economic development, co-ops, and everything are very well placed, and this is what Ian was talking about, the Saikatsu Club in Japan, and also the Agriculture Supporter Community Organization in Japan. Japan now is pushing organic farming up to a certain point, because just another good example, Japan consumes 240,000 tons of organic a year, but only produce 40,000, so most of importance. So, I mean, all these issues, they concern not only international here, they concern what we do in each of our communities, in each of our provinces in Canada. So
it's
a huge issue.
Yeah, and thank you, Yvonne. And I will probably just ask Ian if he wants to add anything about, you said the co-op movement is quite active in food at all levels, but do they mobilize to have an impact on the trade policies? And do you want to add anything on that question? And I will have to wrap up.
Well, I'll give you the traditional co-op response to that, if you don't mind. And that is what we're looking at is an increasing concentration of food production and processing in fewer and fewer hands, and the squeezing of farm producers on all sides. I mean, if you lived in Africa, you would not have a whole lot of sympathy for the farmers' tractors on Paris last week, blocking the streets and complaining about changes, because in comparative terms, the income was so much greater. On the other hand, the pressures on those farmers is tremendous too. Even though they live within, as do people in the United States, a legal environment, a regulatory environment that protects them greatly. So the question is, how do you create world food supply, which is going to be more and more an issue, and it doesn't take a genius to figure that one out. And I'm not sure that the solutions of technology that have worked in some ways quite well in the past are going to work in the future. How do you do that? And the co-op answer, of course, is to maximize the power of the producers in as many ways as you can, and that includes the local support for them. It includes the regulatory and legislative regimes that will encourage that, and in fact will make it possible for slowing down the growth of over commercial agriculture, I would call it. So it's regulatory, which people tend to talk about. It's looking for international trade agreements that would be helpful, but it's also, I think, encouraging and making sure that farm families have control over what they do, and that's the area that would interest me the most. I will stop.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Yvonne. As a speaker, I invite you to go on the wiki regarding trade agreement. When we talk about global center, people-centered economy, we can learn quite a lot from our friends from Latin America who's trying to influence more proactively all the trade agreements right now from their Comercio Justo movement. Go on the wiki to comment on the issue paper, to try to improve it, propose some comment. There's two other upcoming session on partnership and movement building, May 12th, and also a friends session addressing the sixth topic on May 11th. And also the session has been recorded. You want to listen to it again, you want to share it with others. It will be an MP3 file, and you can find that file on FedNEP website, www.fednep.org. rcdec.ca. And thank you for Ashley, Rachel, and all the team who organized it, for the sponsor, and thank you all participants to be there. And thanks again, Ian and Yvonne. And many, many websites have been posted on the chat. I think it will be there for a few more hours or until tomorrow. Don't hesitate to collect those. You need to stay connected. Don't hesitate to connect with SEDNET or any other people who were part of that discussion. Have a good day. It was a pleasure to be with you. And talk to you soon. Hopefully we'll meet at the National Summit in Ottawa at the end of this month. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you, Ottawa.